Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. A river of information flows all around us in today's world. And while digital access to news and entertainment and social media can be enticing and exciting, authors Adam Ghazali and Larry Rosen say the 24/7 availability of information is a distraction that can make it challenging to achieve even simple goals. Ghazali and Rosen are co-authors of The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World. They say multitasking is not an answer. In fact, it isn't a real function of the human brain. And additionally, too much distraction can affect health, sleep, relationships, and safety. We'll talk about all of this on Radio Times. We'll look at some solutions as well, which don't necessarily involve ditching our digital devices. And as always, we'd like to know what you think. 888-477-9499 is the number, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. But first, we welcome our guests. Adam Ghazali is a professor in the departments of neurology, physiology, and psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. Hello, Adam.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Larry Rosen is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Welcome to you as well, Larry.
Thanks for having me.
And some very quick attribution. I did borrow that river of information line from your book because I really liked it. So the human brain is responsible for creating some astounding medical advances in digital technology, architectural wonders, et cetera. But as far as we push the envelope in new directions, our brains remain an ancient brain. Adam Ghazali, tell us a bit in layman's terms about this ancient brain of ours.
Well, you know, our brains obviously have a very long history, starting from our ancient ancestors that navigated a much less complex world than ours. And although we have developed some amazing abilities, which is clear from our creation of society and language and technology, we also have very fundamental limitations in how our brains operate that are no different in many ways than other animals. So we have limited ability to direct our attention in general, but even a less limited ability to distribute it very broadly, to take in all the information around us. We have only a limited capacity of how much information we could hold in mind for brief periods of time. We call that working memory. And when we try to engage in more than one task at a time, what we now call multitasking, we see that our brains don't actually parallel process that information, but rather the networks in the brain need to switch. And with each switch, there's a cost and a decrement in performance. Mm-hmm. So this is why we say that we have ancient brains, because these features of the brain are still limited, and yet we have these very, very high-level goals, which I would say is the ultimate, the pinnacle of the human brain, our ability to set these long, time-delayed, interwoven goals. And yet, when we try to enact them, we collide headfirst with these fundamental ancient limitations.
All right. Well, Larry Rosen, how would you define, then, a distracted mind?
Well, I think the distracted mind is one in which it cannot figure out what to focus on, what to attend to. And so, in fact, instead of, say, a student focusing on reading a textbook, the phone sits next to them and dings or vibrates, and they are distracted. And what we're seeing in all of our research is that technology is one of the major culprits. It is one of the biggest distractors for children, for teenagers, for young adults, even for older adults. And it's ubiquitous. We carry this smartphone with us all the time, 24/7. We sleep with it next to the bed. We wake up in the middle of the night and check the phone, even though we know that it's going to be bad for our sleep. And yet we persist in self-distracting all the time.
So you say sensitivity to interference then is a fundamental vulnerability of the human brain, Larry?
It is a vulnerability of our human brain, and we are sensitive to interference. You can see that just by turning on the television and watching any show like CNN that has a scroll bar on the bottom. And in essence, you either have to focus on what's on the scroll bar or what Anderson Cooper is saying, but you really can't focus on both. And if you try, you realize that you have a very big limitation. The only way you can focus on both is to read a little bit of the scroll bar, listen to Anderson, hope to get a little echo there, go back and read more of the scroll bar before it spills off the edge of the screen, and back and forth and back and forth.
And yet many of us do our work this way. So Adam Guzzelli, we can assume that it's going to take us longer to get the work done. Does it necessarily affect the quality of the work?
We see both. It depends on which study and which population you're looking at, whether it's the workplace or studying or relationships. It depends on the interaction. But we often see a decrease in quality, an increase in the amount of time that it takes to get something done. And then there is the other elements that impact performance, such as an increase in stress or a change in mood. So it does have ramifications across many different elements as opposed to just quality.
I think at heart, most of us know that, you know, if we just put the cell phone down, put the distractions away, we'd be able to really focus on work. But digital information is so enticing. Why is that? Adam?
Well, you know, we as another aspect of our ancient brains is that we seek out information. And one of our concepts that we describe in the book is that we forage for information in the way that our ancestors foraged for food, where they were seeking survival. We've co-opted a lot of those basic systems of reward, and it drives us to forage for information and seek it out voraciously. And now, as you described, our digital devices can supply us with information anywhere we are. And it's not just that. It's that they have the ability to ping us when they want our attention, right? So you get that vibration. You don't have to reach out to them. And so, therefore, just this unprecedented access of information and the way that the information can enter our lives even without us asking for it is just, you know, very enticing. And we also, once you start engaging in that type of behavior where you're multitasking or very rapidly moving between your devices, it has a way of supporting itself and driving that behavior because you get used to that reward cycle, that very, very rapid, quick rewards becomes, and for many people, addicting, or at the very least, a strong draw that persists and helps maintain itself.
You know, Larry Rosen, you know, we've discussed digital technology and, you know, the pros and the cons a number of times on this show, but the addictive nature of it comes up every single time. What's your take?
Well, you know, it's interesting when you talk about addiction. There's really two concepts that we talk about in the book in terms of the psychological impact. One is addiction, which is certainly the pleasure that you get from these devices, that little squirt of dopamine that makes you feel better when somebody pings you, when someone texts you. There's a little anticipation. You feel really good. We're finding in a lot of our research that there's another component here, and that is anxiety. Some people call it a fear of missing out, FOMO. I don't particularly like that term because it really isn't a fear, but it's sort of this concept that we feel anxious if we don't check in constantly, and the reason that we feel that way is because we've sort of dug ourselves into a bit of a hole. We have created this expectation that if someone send us a message that we will respond immediately. If someone posts on social media, we need to jump on and comment or at a minimum like. And so there's this kind of rising anxiety telling the brain, gee, I haven't checked into Facebook for a while. I haven't checked into Instagram for a few minutes. I better check in. And so we're fighting both, as Adam said, both the outside influences, the smartphone dinging at us, the smartphone vibrating, and the inside influences that are driving this behavior. And the two of them together are pretty strong.
So, and how then, what is the effect on, across the board, productivity, do you think, in 2016, work productivity, productivity in school, Adam Guzzelli?
Well, I think the data is convincing that it's having a detrimental effect and that we, you know, we need to change the dialogue, the conversation about technology, you know, just because it's wonderful. And both Larry and I believe that strongly. We love technology. We're not Luddites. That's, I think, a very important point. But we do recognize it just because it offers us so much potential to communicate and to receive information doesn't mean we have to use it all at the same time all the time. And so to us, it's really about decision making based on the information about how our brains work optimally and suboptimally. But, you know, the convergence of data suggesting that it's having a negative impact, and it's beyond the workplace. Maybe we'll talk about this later, beyond work and school, but in other aspects of life.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can get to that as we move through the show, and solutions as well. But back to multitasking. So you say, you know, multitasking, which many of us, including myself, we pride ourselves at being able to do supposedly a number of things at one time. It's something that the brain can't do, and that we've actually seem to have lost the ability to single task as well. Tell us about single tasking, Larry Rosen, and the value of that in keeping your brain healthy and in being productive.
What our brain really wants is to assimilate information, to mix it up with all the information that is stored in our brain, to come up with novel thoughts, with ideas, with different directions to go, with answers to big questions. And the problem is that if we are constantly task switching, constantly attempting to multitask, our brain is not allowed to do this. We're basically processing information at what I would call a very shallow level. And so we're not able to make those kind of big decisions based on good information. I think that's one of the biggest issues that we face is our constant distraction, this constant connectedness, is drawing us away from one of the things that makes us human, which is being able to think through a question and get a good, solid answer based on evidence. What we're seeing is that people, for example, students studying, we see that they study for about 3 to 5 minutes before being distracted. Medical students studying in a medical library, 3 to 5 minutes before being distracted.
Well, and how might, I'm just going to jump in for a second, how might this have worked, say, maybe 3 decades ago? Did you have information as to how long people might have studied, how many minutes before they were distracted?
You know what? There's no data on that because nobody was much worried about that several decades ago. The initial research starting in on looking at multitasking in applied environments, in real-world environments, didn't really start until about, I would say, maybe 10 to 15 years ago. And so what we're seeing, though, is over the 10 to 15 years that we've been looking at this, that the attention span is shortening. Microsoft jokingly said that our attention span is shorter than that of a goldfish. I didn't know that goldfish had an attention span, but evidently they do, and it's in seconds, not in minutes. And we see this in every study that comes out that purports to study multitasking. We see that there's this draw to take your attention from what you're supposed to be doing and direct it to something which may offer communication, connection with friends, information, but it does attract your attention and draw your attention away from the task at hand.
All right. We're talking with Larry Rosen and Adam Ghazali, who are co-authors of The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World. We'll have more just after the break. And if you'd like to join us in the conversation, please do so. Give us a call at 888-477-9499 or an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Welcome back to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We're talking about distraction and the human brain and how this can hinder productivity. Our guests, Adam Ghazali, who is a professor in the Department of Neurology, also Physiology, Psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. Larry Rosen is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at California State University, Dominguez Hills, and they are co-authors of The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World. And we were talking about to touch on distraction and technology and performance on the college level. And I'd like to get to a phone call because I think this is related to this. So let's go to Tia in Upper Darby. Welcome to Radio Times, Tia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 39 and I recently returned to college and I finished my undergrad. And I think the generation, most of the students are in their 19, early 20s. And they always have their phones out during the class time. Not only do they have their phones out, but many of them don't even take notes. They take a picture of the screen instead of taking notes, and they situation that they must have their phones with them at all times. There's times in the class, before class has even started, there are several people there. No one talks to each other. Everyone is sitting there looking down at their phones. They don't interact with each other the same. It's very strange to me because my generation didn't have those things. And although I have a smartphone, I don't feel compelled at all to pull it out during class. In my mind, I'm saying, absolutely not. That's disrespectful to the teacher. But to them, it seems very normal. And there are even signs on the wall that say, no texting during class.
Yeah.
So I wonder how this will affect this generation and their knowledge.
Thank you, Tia. Thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. You raise an important question. You've got two generations very close to each other in age, and yet some huge differences. So Larry Rosen, what were you hearing in what Tia was saying?
One I thought was interesting that she said students always
You know what? I think we're having some issues with the phone line with you, Larry. So what we'll do is we'll call you right back and get that line reestablished. But in the meantime, let's toss that to Adam Ghazali. Again, two different generations. One, Tia feels she can just put her phone away and focus on the professor in class. But, this generation behind her, at least her observation, people aren't talking to each other. The phones are out. There's just a completely different vibe. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, she described it, perfectly. I could not have said it better myself, and it's great to have someone that witnessed that and experiences that on a daily basis, describe it so eloquently. I mean, that is really the hallmark of the distracted mind, that inability to lock down all your streams of information, even when you know you should be focusing on one thing, even when you're told you should be focusing on one thing, even when it might be rude to not focus on that one thing. In this case, the classroom, but it could just as easily be your significant other across the table. And we do see that behavior is more prevalent in the younger generation. That's probably not surprising. Maybe Tia is a great listener and a great focuser, but we also see this behavior is not limited to the younger generation. There are many people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, even seniors that are struggling with the same distracted mind that we see in younger adults. Granted, there are less of them. The prevalence is definitely higher in the younger generation, but it is something that affects everyone in their own way. I think that was a great observation.
Well, in your book, you talk about the prefrontal cortex, where I guess the action is for goal setting and goal enactment. And also, you mentioned that it's this area of the brain, if I'm correct, is not fully developed until a person is a young adult. So, what's the effect of all this technology and distraction on children and developing brains? What have you found, Adam?
It's one of the main questions that I hear. And it's such a critical one, and it's one that concerns many of us because there are so many unknowns, and it's not subtle. I mean, the impact of all the amazing technology on that generation is profound in many ways. If you just watch young people interacting, it's so different than the way that the previous generations did. We are learning a lot about the acute effects. So if you do behave in the way that was described in classroom, we know that there's an impact on performances, an increase in stress. We know that the same thing happens when people are studying. We also know that young people that media multitask more frequently tend to have greater distractibility when you test them in the laboratory. But the important thing to note is that data is correlational. So it doesn't really say for sure that the act of media multitasking leads you to become more distractible, but there are multiple studies that are starting to come out that suggest that might be the case. So what I'm describing here is our evidence base is really built around the moment, what is happening right now, how distraction and fragmenting your attention degrades performance and impacts your life negatively. what we don't know very well, because the data just doesn't exist, is what are the long-term consequences of this? And part of the problem is that technology is moving so rapidly that by the time, you know, we're doing a study, you know, now virtual reality is here. It changes so quickly. So we still have a bit of a question mark on that. Obviously, a lot of concern, but not a clear answer.
So technology is an integral part of education today, not only on the college level, of course, but, you know, K through 12 as well. And in this book, you do offer solutions, which we'll try to get to throughout the hour. You know, as far as education is concerned, you're not necessarily saying, Larry Rosen, you know, dump the technology in the classroom. It's more a matter of how you integrate it properly.
I think it's a combination of two things. I think one, it's how you integrate the technology judiciously. Hmm. There's this tendency to want to just dump technology into a classroom and say, this is great. Everybody use technology throughout the whole class and everything will be wonderful and you have access to all this information. But I think the second part is more important, and that is being able to focus on something for an extended period of time. And what the technology right now is doing is it's challenging what I would call our digital metacognition, our ability to make smart choices. And what we're seeing, for example, in some of our most recent research, is college students unlock their phone 60 times a day. That's 60 times a day. That's about every 15 minutes of waking time for about close to 4 hours. So if they're using their phone for close to 4 hours a day, they're using a lot in the classroom, and they're using it a lot when they're with their significant other and when they're with their family and when they're with their friends. I think that you're starting to see a bit of concern out there of this lifestyle that is centered around this little box. Concern such that some young adults will do what they call a cell phone stack, and they'll all be at a restaurant and they'll all take their phones and turn them off and stick them in the center of the table upside down, with the idea that the first person who can't stand it anymore and needs to check their phone has to pay the entire bill.
Oh, wow.
That's a pretty radical solution.
And yet there's some self-realization there. You know,
yes, that's exactly right. There's what I would call digital metacognition. It's understanding that you really don't want to be talking on your phone or looking at your phone while you're trying to have conversations with your friends. We're seeing the same thing between spouses, where one spouse is constantly on their phone, maybe while they're watching television, they're using a second screen, which is very common, and that this is negatively impacting their relationship.
Hmm. All right, let's get back to the phones. Ryan in Moores, I should say yes, Ryan in Mooresville, you are waiting, and we are going to go to you right now, and you are on Radio Times. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, ma'am. How are you? It's actually Brian with a B.
Oh, sorry.
No worries. So I was saying, as an adult with ADHD, you know, I'm not able to take the medicine because I have an addiction history in my 20s, and I just sort of figured out, you know, various coping strategies that have taken, you know, 33 years to figure out. And I actually think the opposite is true from what you were just saying about the sort of mode switching. I found that I can't fight the context switching from mode to mode to mode, so I try and harness it. So, like, for instance, right now I'm taking a class and I have to read Plato's Dialogues. So I will have Plato's Dialogues on my Kindle, on my laptop, and load it up as the audiobook in my car, so that no matter how many times I context switch or how many modes I change, it's still the same content. And I've found that by overlapping different modes but with the same content, I'm able to actually get through the material by not fighting the switching, but just making sure that the switching is you know, has the same content. I've also discovered that, you know, you can't fight the need to be able to be doing multiple things at the same time. So, you know, drawing or doodling or driving my car while listening to an audiobook allows me to get through content and retain more than trying to focus exclusively on one thing.
All right, Ryan, you've got several important points that I'm sorry for cutting you off there, but several important points that we need to get to. Adam Ghazali, first of all, interestingly, he says you can't fight the need to do a number of things, I guess, at the same time. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, It depends a lot on the person. So it's very possible that he might not be able to fight that need. And, you know, this diagnosis of ADHD is very complex, but that is one of the features of it. And some people will not be able to. And that is a whole other discussion on the clinical side of how do you treat ADHD to allow people that absolutely cannot pay attention in any circumstances to find the way through, whether it's drug or newer therapies that are being designed. But outside of the medical context, I believe that it is possible to focus on one thing. And, you know, from an N of one as well, my own perspective on this is that it is hard to do. Larry mentioned anxiety, which is a factor. We talked about accessibility of technology and the expectations, which are a factor. Another factor is boredom. And we could talk about that as well, which increases the longer you stay engaged in one thing. But there is a way. It's a lot of what we talk about in terms of strategies at the end of the book. And it's not easy, just like running a marathon is not easy. It's a stepwise process, and there are ways to get better at it, and there's the value of breaks, which is important. But it is possible, and it does improve performance if you're capable of doing it. The one last thing I'll just mention right there is that sure. It doesn't mean that you have to single task all the time. There is a time for multitasking and a time for single tasking, as Larry and I both feel that it's not like multitasking is evil and it never needs to be done, but there can be a balance.
Well, Ryan had mentioned it seems from what he was saying that it, for him, and he's got the ADHD, it seemed that switching back and forth to various media helped him to learn. Is there something to that? Is there an actual positive in certain circumstances? Larry Rosen, what do you think?
I think what he's trying to do is desperately trying to find a way to focus. And so what he's doing is he's taking the main object of his focus, reading a book of material, and he's trying to put it in every environment, every context in which he exists. I think that's great. That's certainly a positive way of looking at it. I would call that somebody who's metacognitively aware that he needs this material in more than one environment. And perhaps, as he said, in more than one sensory modalities. Some of it was auditory, and he was listening to it. Some of it was visual. He was reading the book. I think this is, again, his attempt to fight something that seems right now so natural and so common, which is to be distracted. And it's a tough fight. We've not gotten here quickly. This didn't happen overnight. This has been a process. It began a decade and a half ago with smartphones, and it's continuing to insinuate itself into everything we do. And what's important, and I think what Brian said is very important, is that he's able to figure out a little bit of a way around it, a little bit of a solution that works for him. I think that's going to be very important for people to first recognize what it's doing to their attention and drawing their attention, and then trying to work on some solutions in order to better their focus and to better their attention.
So just one more moment on college, and then we'll move on. Let's talk about solutions. If you have a young person who is taking a class and has to study really hard to get through whatever, microbiology, what is your recommendation? Say this young person has a cell phone by his or her side at all times, and you know this is part of their life. I mean, how do you recommend actually getting studying so that you can get the most out of it and trying to weed out distractions? Adam Ghazali, what do you say?
Well, we can definitely talk about this for the rest of the hour because it's a very complex topic, and there's lots of different strategies. I'll just throw out one to start the process of moving through this. The idea of developing the cognitive skills to have singular attention to one piece of information, one stream of information, one task, we think is critical. And if you start with baby steps, so you don't say, I'm going to sit down and read this book for 1 hour without interruption, because if you do that, you're likely to fail. You'll be bored to death. You'll have your anxiety will tear you apart. But rather to start with smaller chunks of time and to plan breaks. Maybe that's 10 minutes of focused work and then a break. But What's critical here is the type of break that you're taking. If the type of break that you're taking is to go on Facebook, it's going to begin this iterative cycle of communication that will take you farther and farther away from your goal. Rather, there are breaks such as, you know, brief physical exercise or taking a walk or exposing yourself to nature or type of mindfulness and meditation practices that would be better breaks, and then returning and slowly over time building up the skills to accomplish that goal of longer and longer sustained attention to that one task.
And Larry Rosen, do we have to embrace boredom perhaps a little bit here?
I think that boredom is highly underrated here. And I think that as a species, that boredom has a major function. When you are bored, your brain goes into a mode that allows you to do creative thinking, mind wandering, daydreaming. And these are really important to generating ideas, to seeing things in a different way, to simply letting your brain put things together that you might not have if you were constantly switching from task A to task B. I think, and again, there's no evidence for this, but I think that what we're going to see is that boredom, the level of boredom in our society, has increased steadily over the last several decades. And I believe that that's because we have so many enticing things that are drawing our attention away that we don't allow ourselves to be bored. So if we're standing in line in a movie theater, instead of talking to the people around us about what we expect to see in the movie or what our favorite movies are, we instead instantly grab this enticing smartphone, which holds all of our communication, all of our music, all of everything, and it gives us this sense of pleasure, but we miss out on this concept of being able to be bored or to be social in situations that might be uncomfortable. This is a major issue for us.
Yeah. So if we embrace some of these strategies, and Adam Ghazali, this hypothetical college student, will he or she perhaps find a better score on the test or a better grade in the class?
I mean, it's what we can extrapolate from the data that exists right now. We need to do more intervention studies. I think that we're at the point right now where we have a very rich appreciation of the impact and how broad it is across, you know, the life activities that one engages in. But now how do we engage these strategies and other approaches that I assume we'll talk about for the rest of the hour, and then produce the data that shows us that these are actually having the positive impact we expect them to?
All right, Adam Ghazali and Larry Rosen are co-authors of The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World. And we'll continue the conversation in just a moment here on Radio Times. And we'll take some of your calls and comments as well. Keep it here. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we're talking about the river of information we swim in our modern lives and the effect that distraction has on the brain and productivity. And our guests this hour, Larry Rosen, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at California State University, Dominguez Hills, and also Adam Ghazali, who is a professor in the departments of neurology, physiology, and psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. They have teamed up to write The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World. And we're also taking your calls at 888-477-9499. So we'll get to the calls in just a second. That's a promise. But first, I did want to get to sleep and how sleep habits have changed, devices, and how all this can kind of lead to distraction and the brain. So, Adam, if you would, give us a brief primer on red wavelength light, blue light, melatonin, and devices.
Yeah, so there's an accumulation of information that the exposure to the blue light in the evening, which is not natural, is increasing the disruption of the quality of our sleep and affecting melatonin in essence. And so we, you know, these devices are held close to the face very frequently. You know, that certainly seems to be a factor that impacts sleep, as well as just using devices late into the evening. So you can, you know, there's a accumulation of evidence showing this impact on young people, on the amount of quality sleep that they're getting and how it impacts their performance the next day.
And so when you say late into the evening, what would you recommend in terms of, you know, shutting them down before sleep? How many hours or minutes?
There's the evidence of what the best time to do this is not out there, but most people are starting to look at, you know, an hour before bedtime, limiting technology, you know, charging your phones outside of your bedroom, not right next to your bed. You know, people are not just using technology before they go to sleep, but they're waking up in the middle of the night to check in. They're waking, you know,
what does
first
that do
thing
to
in the morning.
Brain? If you go and you check that text message at midnight, does it give a shot of not adrenaline, but just a shot of wakefulness?
Yeah, I mean, it disrupts the natural sleep cycles that are critical. I mean, sleep is an important element for our health, for our memory consolidation. And when it's disrupted and you enter these cycles that pull you away from the natural stages of sleep, there could be, you know, a host of ramifications on not just your health, but, you know, your performance, your mood, your level of stress. And then, you know, it's often the first thing that people see in the morning as they, you know, pull open their sleepy eyes, you know, they're right again in their screens.
And so, Larry Rosen, how does all this affect the ability to focus and to accomplish goals during the day?
Well, as Adam said, sleep is absolutely critical. And one of the things that sleep is critical for is what's called consolidation. And what that is that in the middle of the night, your brain, if you're going through normal sleep cycles and a normal restful sleep cycle, which many people don't have, by the way, your brain takes information from the day, reworks it, puts it together, practices it, and makes sure that it is consolidated in your brain. If you don't get a good night's sleep, or you disrupt that sleep by what many people do, which is waking up in the middle of the night and checking their phone for something other than the time, and it's often a communication, a text message, an email, something like that. But that isn't happening. And so the next day when you get up, first of all, you're not going to feel as rested. But second of all, you're not going to have as good a memory for the material that your brain was supposed to be working on during the sleep cycles. That means you're going to wake up not remembering quite what you thought you were supposed to do with that project at work, or what your boss told you. You can remember some of what he said, but not all of it. The lecture material in a class, obviously, what your wife asked you to do the next day when you got up. There's all sorts of ramifications of what a bad night's sleep will do. And all of our work shows that 3/4 of people sleep with their phone, particularly young people, sleep with their phone close enough that they can touch with their hand. Many of them put it in their hand, under their pillow, in their pillowcase. And half of those check it at least one or more times during the night for something other than just the time.
Well, Larry Rosen, what does this tell you? What does this tell you?
Well, it tells me two things. One, that phone carries a lot of information and a lot of draw. And even in a sleepy, non-waking situation, it still can capture our brains. And second of all, what it tells me is that people are not being very metacognitive. They're not thinking clearly about what this can do to them, and they're willingly allowing it to disrupt their sleep cycle, perhaps even knowing very well that this is not good for their brain, not good for their health, their mental health, or their physical health.
So, all right, so the solution here, if families, parents are listening, the conversation to have around the dinner table quickly would be what? Regarding technology and sleep. What would you advise, Larry Rosen?
Well, the ideal, and again, I say the ideal in quotes, the ideal is what the National Sleep Foundation suggests, and it suggests this based on a lot of research, that you take your phone out of your bedroom within an hour before you go to sleep or intending to go to sleep, and then do some activity that is calming. A lot of the recommendations say you can listen to music, but particularly music that you know very well, that is very ingrained in the brain. You can read a paper book or you can read a book off of a device, but lower the light so that the blue light is not negatively impacting the melatonin. You can watch television, strangely, because the television is usually far enough away that the blue light does not impact your retinal image. There's lots of activities you can do, but the basic one is to National Sleep Foundation says take the phone out of the bedroom 1 hour before sleep.
All right. Let's get to we've got a lot of comments and some calls to get to. So let's get to the comment from Richard, who asks how does this idea of multitasking play out in the job market, i.e. employers list many job requirements as, quote, ability to multitask is a must, end quote. So how do we go back to the division of labor idea? Adam Ghazali, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, we all know that this was a request that we were seeing in the job market. People were putting it on their resumes. You know, they're a good multitasker. Hopefully that conversation is changing. And that's one of the goals of writing this book and doing radio shows like this, is to help start the dialogue that, you know, a skill that is one to be proud of is that you're a good single tasker. You're good at focusing and getting the job done in a directed way. And so, you know, that is you know, starting to penetrate society, and hopefully it'll continue to.
All right. One of the solutions that you offer in the book, you talk about the value of meditation, and this just kind of goes right into this email from Tony, who asks, he wonders if you noticed a recent op-ed in the New York Times titled Actually Let's Not Be in the Present Moment. It was an argument by a 30-something against mindfulness practice, despite more than 3 years of evidence for its efficacy in combating exactly the sorts of distractions being discussed. I did see this op-ed myself. So what do you think, pro and con to meditation as a way to help fight distractions and promote a healthier brain? Larry, let's go to you first.
Okay.
First of all, the whole point of meditation, particularly mindful meditation, is to be present. It is to be in the moment. And part of what happens when you are task switching so often, you are multitasking, is you're not being present. You are being distracted. You're being interrupted, allowing to be interrupted. I think that what skill that we need to be harvesting among our young people and among our workers is not the ability to multitask. It's the ability to be able to focus and know when it is a good time to switch from one task to the next. We're not saying you shouldn't switch. What we're saying is that people don't allow themselves enough time to focus on a task or to get to the end of a paragraph or the end of a page or the end of a chapter before their attention is jerked away to something else. And so it's really, again, this sort of concept of really being in present in the moment and being able to know when you're in the moment, when it is a good time to change your focus and when it is a bad time to change your focus.
Adam?
Well, you know, these are ancient practices, mindfulness and other meditation activities. And if you look at the scientific literature that, you know, is relatively recent, you will find evidence that they improve attention and also have an impact on stress and mood in a positive way. At their core, what we're talking about, they're really attention exercises. Can you focus on something as subtle as your breath, maintain it, learn your inner space better, that you can recognize when you're being distracted and pull that attention back to that focus of your breath? I think that the convergence of evidence would suggest that these are powerful tools that can have a positive impact in our daily lives. For many people, meditation practices are very challenging to do for obvious reasons, but there are other approaches. We're even working on them in our laboratory that might be able to baby step people into these approaches more easily.
All right. David in Philadelphia has been waiting patiently. You're live on Radio Times, David.
Hello.
Hi.
Question. I'm a painter. I've been listening to this program for years. I paint and I listen, and I'm not sure whether I'm using different parts of the brain to do those two tasks, or if I'm just switching back and forth between strokes, between words. What do your experts think?
I don't know. That's a good question, David. Adam Ghazali, why don't you take that first?
Well, you know, when we talk about not being able to multitask, what we're really describing is the inability for your brain to parallel process two attention-demanding activities. And that's very critical that you know, I emphasize attention-demanding. Many times we do more than one thing, right? The classic walking and chewing gum. It's because you've offloaded some of the things that we do all the time to automatic processes that don't involve the same attention systems. So when you're doing something that's as practiced as painting is to you, many of the elements of it are automatic. But I would say that when you are engaged in the creative moments of it, when you're making a decision that demands attention, that's what you're doing. And you've switched away from listening and you're doing that. And then you switch back when you're doing something more automatic, like a stroke that's well practiced. So I'd say in many ways you are actually switching there, even if it's not obvious or in your awareness.
And okay, thanks for the call to Radio Times, David. Let's go to Craig in Phoenixville. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hello. I just had a couple comments to say. I noticed that you guys were talking about multitasking and that being part of a job search. I'm a software developer, and in the past 20 years or so, I've noticed that that has started to already shift. People are now looking more for somebody that can focus. And a lot of the processes involved in software development are about focusing down as well. And this has been a problem that's been going on for a long time, not just with, you know, smartphones. Before the smartphones came along, computers had the same problem with email, chat, RSS feeds, things like that. But we're already starting to see those shifts.
So, Craig, are you finding greater productivity then with single tasking?
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things that's really kind of a core component to something that's called Agile. Which is all really about focusing and leaving the developers alone to get their job done. Yeah. And without that focus, with people coming in and saying, hey, what's going on with this? Or, hey, can you fix this? Or send emails and all that kind of stuff. If they're not able to focus, productivity drops.
Craig, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We appreciate it. So Larry's just confirming what you've been saying.
Yeah, it was interesting, his comment, because the research is very clear, particularly the research having to do with software developers. There's a very interesting study where they shadowed software developers for 3 days, 8 hours a day, 24 hours total, and marked down everything they did, every time they focused, every time they got distracted, what distracted them. The focus span for software developers was about 3 to 5 minutes. And interestingly enough, when they looked at what distracted them, about half the time it was some sort of electronic communication, usually an email. But half the time there was no clear distractor. And so that distractor came from internal sources, your brain telling you the kinds of things that kids' brains tell you all the time. I have to check into Facebook. I have to make sure that nobody's commented or whether somebody's commented on my post on Instagram.
So, Larry, we're just about out of time. I just want to ask you, so how do you waylay those thoughts? Any advice?
There's lots of strategies to waylay those thoughts. But I think, again, the key is, as Adam and I have both been saying, is that this has crept up on us. This has not happened overnight. It's happened slowly, and we need to slowly back ourselves off. One of the things that I highly recommend is that you start trying to focus for short periods of time, 10 to 15 minutes. And in order to do that, you turn off all the distractions. You get them all out of your field and set an alarm for 15 minutes. When that alarm goes off in 15 minutes, you give yourself a minute to check in, to allay that anxiety, to feel better, and then go back and focus for 15 minutes. When you're good at 15 minutes, up it to 20. When you're good at 20, up at 25, 30. I think for many of us, we're not even focusing for 3 to 5 minutes. So 30 minutes of focus would be magnificent.
Yeah. And we've only got about 10 seconds left. But Adam, the reward will be what? Greater productivity.
not just greater productivity, less stress, better mood. I think it'll penetrate pretty much every aspect of a person's life if they practice and get better at focus.
All right, Adam Ghazali is professor in the departments of neurology, physiology, and psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. Larry Rosen, professor emeritus of psychology at California State University, Dominguez Hills, and they are co-authors of The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World. We thank you so much for joining us. And remember, if you get the chance, visit our Facebook page and check out our podcasts. Head to whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, great to have you along for Radio Times.